Good evening. It's nice to see you all here tonight. Welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, the Curator of Education, and this is absolutely one of the best parts of my job, so I'm glad you're here to enjoy it with me. Next week is the annual Fort Worth AIA Design Competition. And as in years past, the lead juror for that competition will speak for Tuesday evenings. This year, that architect is Julie Snow, and she's here to share the work of her Minneapolis-based firm, as well as current ideas in architecture. Tonight, we are very fortunate to have one of our own with us, and while I think everyone in the audience knows and appreciates Dr. Frances Colpitt and her accomplishments, I want to remind us all of her contributions of late. In her position as the D.D. Potter Rose Chair in Contemporary Art History at TCU, Dr. Colpitt has challenged, encouraged, and prepared graduate, undergraduate art history and studio students who have gone on to make contributions of their own in their various fields of art. This museum is, in fact, the beneficiary with three of her outstanding TCU grads, now holding positions in curatorial, education, and publishing here. The Modern is quite grateful for that and for the fact that Fran graciously accepts our invitations to participate in all kinds of programming, such as tonight's lecture. More broadly, we in the DFW community owe Fran our appreciation for elevating the conversation by similarly participating in such activities across the Metroplex. For example, recently she shed light on the challenging work of former art and language artist and SMU Art Department Chair Michael Corris, as she publicly spoke with Michael in conjunction with his show at the Reading Room in Dallas. In spring of 2010, I was particularly moved by Fran's exhibition essay on a specific body of work by Dallas-based artist John Wilcox at the Barry Whistler Gallery. And as always, I learned a great deal recently from a conversation I attended between Fran and art historian and curator Charlie Wiley as part of the DMA's programming on a particular installation of their contemporary collection. I could, of course, go on and on. Needless to say, Dr. Frances Colpitt is earning her keep here in this community. Then there is her long and illustrious career as a nationally recognized scholar of modern and contemporary art. As many of you know, Dr. Colpitt wrote the seminal text on minimalism, Minimalism, the Critical Perspective. She is a longtime corresponding editor of Art in America and occasionally curates with some impressive exhibitions to her credit. I invite you all to be on the lookout for an exhibition, in fact, this coming spring at the Fort Worth Contemporary, the TCU Gallery. For tonight's lecture, it is important to remind you of Fran's ongoing relationship with abstraction, and in particular, abstraction's history and current practices in Southern California, which she has explored in two recent publications, Hard Edge Cool and Birth of the Cool, California Art, Design, and Culture at Mid-Century and In and Out of the Studio and Under the Big Black Sun, California Art in the Age of Pluralism, 1974 to 81. Organized by the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. Excuse me. For tonight's lecture, Problems and Possibilities for Abstract Painting in Postmodernism, Fran has drawn on her interest and expertise as she has revisited and reconsidered problems of abstract painting in our postmodern electronic age, coming up with some new and interesting conclusions that she will share with us tonight. And I have to say, we were discussing before the lecture and we were recalling that this all grew out of a conversation that we were having and some struggles she was having with these concepts. So if you think just because she has this long, illustrious career and that she wrote the book on minimalism and she is the expert on so many of these topics that this was an easy to come by, you're wrong. She actually fought hard for this lecture and is still, I think, uncovering some of her conclusions or testing some of her conclusions. She says this is, in fact, a work in progress, so we're the fortunate beneficiaries of letting her work it out in front of us. So please join me in welcoming Frances Colpitt.
Thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. I don't want you to get your hopes up. As Terry said, I asked her to sort of reinforce this. This is very much a work in progress. I was asked by my old friend Michael Corris, who is now the chair at SMU in the art department, to contribute a volume to his series, an upcoming series that he's publishing at Reaction Books in London on contemporary issues in art. And he asked me to work on the topic of abstraction since 1980, which is not something I have really, really focused on. I certainly know about it, and I know how to teach about it. I know how to write a little bit about it. But it's not an area that I'm comfortable in yet. There are lots of pitfalls in the 21st century for abstract painting in particular, which is what I really want to talk about. So the first half of what I'm talking about tonight has more to do with the problems that abstraction and painting face in the postmodern era, in the 21st century. The second half will be a little bit more optimistic. I hope. I was almost crying writing the first half of this talk. This is so depressing. Painting is dead. You know, and it really is kind of depressing. So I'm hoping that the second half is more upbeat, as, you know, now here is really what we need to focus on. So that's the approach. And I would love everybody's response. If you can think of, you know, helpful criticisms, I'd be very, very appreciative. I want to look then at the issues and problems for abstract art in the postmodern era. I don't want to talk about abstraction as a trend or a fashion or a style. That was a way it was talked about in the 1980s. There was this little sort of boomlet of abstract painting in the 80s, and the critics frequently referred to it as abstraction is back in style. And that is not what I want to talk about at all. Mark Rosenthal, who is otherwise a very respectable art historian and curator, and wrote a wonderful book on 20th century abstraction that's really an amazing compendium of everything in abstract painting that had happened during the 20th century, calls it abstractionism. And my skin just, I just can't, the idea of abstractionism makes me really crazy. It isn't that. It is a philosophical approach to life and experience in the world. And I want to talk about abstraction as a philosophically coherent language, as a form of communication, not a style, not a period style, not a trend, not a fashion. And I won't be talking about individual artists or individual works of art tonight, but really what is at stake for abstraction and in particular abstract painting in our time. Can I have the slides, John? I guess we'll put lights down and slides up. If you were to listen to the critics, if you were to listen to the postmodern theorists, abstraction would be no longer relevant or even possible in the 21st century. And people who are making abstract paintings are simply beating a dead horse. They're sort of banging their head against the wall. It is not, according to most postmodern critics, the language of our era. And there are two arguments against abstraction in the 21st century. One is made by Yves Alain-Bois, a brilliant critic whose essay, Painting, The Task of Mourning, is one of the best essays on the problems of abstract painting at the end of the 20th century. In Painting, The Task of Mourning, Bois says that abstraction is the emblem of modernism, which I think is perfectly true. Abstraction is the one thing that modern art can be said to have invented, to have contributed, that distinguishes it from any other era ever. I mean, it really is its greatest, most distinct contribution. If modernism is over, if we have entered a postmodern era, then abstraction is over. It's relegated to the 20th century. So that's one argument against abstraction in the 21st century. The second one is that abstraction is closely linked to painting. I'm going to show you some slides in a minute that I hope will demonstrate that a little bit more thoroughly. But it is painting's most, and this is being a very modernist thing to say, but painting's purest form of expression is abstraction. That's getting rid of everything in painting, but painting itself. So if we were to eliminate everything, we would have abstract painting. And if painting is no longer really possible, now this is all theoretical, right? People, of course, are still painting. But if painting is no longer possible, then neither is abstraction. If painting has died, as theoreticians tell us, then so has abstraction. So I'll unpack both of those ideas in just a minute, but just to give you an idea of where I'm going to go. Then, running up against these two things which seem to hold us back and don't allow the possibility of abstract painting, the relevance of abstract painting in the postmodern era, artists are still working abstractly. Many artists are painting and working in an abstract language, not only in painting, but photography and video. It's spread to the other flat arts, I guess, or the two-dimensional arts. And we see a lot more abstract painting, abstract video than we'd ever seen 10 years ago right now. So it seems to be as much practice today as it ever was, as popular and pervasive as ever. That was the sort of thing that I confronted, trying to figure out what does it mean to make abstract art today. We've got these two things telling us that it is impossible to do it, it's irrelevant to do it, and then we have this indisputable fact that artists are still working abstractly. So I thought that I would start first by talking very generally about the differences between postmodernism and modernism. I know for some of you this is all familiar territory, and for others maybe something you hadn't thought about before. Postmodernism has replaced modernism, and I think that's an indisputable fact. And so I chose the two paintings on the screen to sort of start making some formal comparisons between postmodernism and modernism, allowing Diebenkorn's painting to stand for the modern period. And Alison Miller, who's a young Los Angeles painter, to have her work as an emblem of postmodernism, a recent work that you see there on the screen. Essentially, modernism was a formally based era. Artists were interested in formal issues like balance and harmony, and above all, unity. The sort of driving force of modern art was unity, wholeness, and singularity. That a painting had to, as artists used to say, hang together. And I think they still talk this way. But modern art was attempting to arrive at this singularity and a wholeness. Diebenkorn's painting, for example, does, I think, represent a kind of, not only a kind of singularity and a wholeness and an indivisibility, the absence of discrete parts, for example, but also a lived time and space. There is a sense of life being lived in his paintings, abstractly, not optically or retinally, but lived time, certainly through his use of the pentimenti, the erased lines. You see the traces of the process in the final painting, so that it has this temporal quality. It seems to sort of unfold in terms of process before your eyes, and spatially in its landscape-like space, the subtle illusion of a space behind the picture plane. There is a sense of flux, and those erasures, I think, really give you that sense of the process in time, the change that the painting went through, the weight of the elements in the work, the gravity, the response to gravity, to balance. The whole thing has a harmonic balance that Miller really in her work rejects. Her work has an awkwardness. I mean, if you just look at the quality, here's a sort of connoisseurship sort of idea, but just look at the quality of her line, which is quirky and hesitant. It isn't that ghostly, erased, redrawn line of Diebenkorn that sort of slowly comes into view. Oh, she's got these snaky, awkward quirky kinds of lines and an off-key palette. I tried to pick two paintings that were sort of close in palette, in color, but were just enough different that you could see the differences in the postmodern, and I'm very generalizing here, the postmodern palette. She pays no heed to gravity. Where Diebenkorn painted upright on an easel, as most traditional painters do, she paints from all sides. She turns the painting around and works on it upside down and inside out and sideways. She has no idea what the top or the bottom of the painting is going to be until she's finished. She looks at the thing and then decides, sort of juggles it around on the wall and decides finally what the optimum position is for the work, which is unimaginable in Diebenkorn. You cannot turn a Diebenkorn upside down at all. It would completely fall apart. Her space is not the space of landscape that is lived space, space you experience with your body, but the space of a notepad or even a computer screen, right, that she's doodling on. You have a sense of filling space with this, with the line, creating a more chaotic and accumulative composition. And this, I think, reflects the postmodernists' desire to, in a way, be truer to not perhaps lived life, as the phenomenologist would say, but truer to life, which is messy and chaotic and often confused and fragmented and so forth. So that kind of irresolution, I think, is very much a part of what she's trying to get at in a painting that is less pure than Diebenkorn's modernism. Postmodernism, of course, was first manifested in architecture, and that seems to make the distinctions most clear. I've chosen Mises' Barcelona Pavilion, or the German Pavilion in Barcelona, in 1929, representing the country of Germany in Barcelona in 1929, and Frank Gehry's house in Santa Monica, which he renovated in 1978. Those same formal structural differences that I discussed with the two paintings a minute ago are even more apparent, I think, in this comparison. The postmodernist, represented by the Gehry architectural work on the right, is no longer interested in pursuing what the modernist called reduction. That is, a progressive, century and a half long elimination of the unnecessary, which is basically what the modern critic, formalist Clement Greenberg advocated, was the elimination of anything not necessary to making, in his case, he was talking about a painting, not architecture. But you can certainly see that here, where Mises has stripped the building down to its structural elements, elegant, simplicity of architecture, in his case. On the right, we see that Gehry is not interested in less being more, but actually in more being more, adding extraneous elements, adding unnecessary, non-functional elements to the architecture of his house. On the right, using industrial materials such as corrugated steel and fencing material on the top. You can see surrounding the balcony on the top is that kind of cross wire fencing. All kinds of industrial, typically non-domestic sorts of materials of filling the architectural space. And this is typical of the technique of pastiche, which the critic and philosopher critic Frederick Jameson, who's going to be central to my argument, defined as the technique, the methodology of postmodernism. Pastiche is a kind of pasting together of disparate materials or images from various sources and sort of combining them in this pastry-like stew of unrelated elements, along with the rejection of reduction, of the simplification that we see in modern art. We also see in postmodernism a rejection of the notion of progress or the notion of advance that is so dear to the heart of the modernist. And when I talk about modernism in general, I'm not simply talking about modern artists, but about all of us who lived during the modern period. We were modernists, whether we made art or not. One of the things that characterized our period of modernism, the 20th century up until the 1970s or 80s, is this faith in progress, this belief that tomorrow was going to be better than today. It was an unshakable belief the modernists had in the future, which made them futurists. If you think of the three examples I always use to talk to students about this idea, if you think of the progress represented by highways, that small towns in the 1950s wanted highways to come through, wanted interstates to bring traffic into the town, and highways proliferated in the 1950s and the 1960s. Think of Kennedy's space program, an emblem for the modern era. The space program would propel us into the future. Or technology, that is, technology was going to make our lives better. There was no question about that at the time, that the future would be better, tomorrow would be better than today. Now we look from a different perspective at those same kinds of situations and don't see them as necessarily better. We don't see that more highways are necessarily the solution. In fact, we have traffic jams. The more highways we have, the more traffic we have. The space program has resulted not in the most optimistic progress and the winning of the Cold War, but in things like the Challenger shuttle disaster, where astronauts' lives were lost. And technology, medical technology, which we thought was always going to make the world a better place, has produced the possibility of things as potentially disastrous as human cloning. So there are all kinds of things that we now see from a postmodern perspective that weren't necessarily good. They may be progress, but they're not necessarily good. And then I want to argue that, and this one's harder to make. This is a harder argument to make, but somehow I just know it. I want to argue that I feel it in my bones, that abstraction is essentially a pictorial language rather than a three-dimensional pursuit. There have been examples of abstract sculpture, lots of them, and since 1915, at least, with 1914, with Vladimir Tatlin in Russia, making three-dimensional work out of industrial materials that had no recognizable referent. So it will be acceptable as abstract sculpture. But when we think of abstraction, I think ultimately we're thinking about abstraction in painting. And I wanted to look at the work of John Armleder here just for a second, because I think, again, this is something I can't even articulate, but I think it sort of shows that it's true, that his painting on the left is abstract. It is non-referential. It doesn't refer to an object existing in the real world, where his sculpture on the right, which is a room installation with the painted wall and the couch and the lamps are all part of the sculptural installation, doesn't seem abstract. It seems too real to be abstract. Armleder is a very interesting artist and a model for somebody. If you want to look at abstraction's shift, it's marked in Armleder. He starts out as a young artist in the 60s and is associated and affiliated with the Fluxus movement in Switzerland in the 1960s. And then in the 70s, he begins to make more abstract work, and in the 80s, he's picked up by the artists or the critics who were writing about what was called Neo Geo, the work of Peter Halley, for example, or Philip Taff in the 1980s. So he gets sort of co-opted by the young, early postmodern abstraction artists associated with Neo Geo. He is a painter and a sculptor and a curator, and it seems to me that his work really does, his three-dimensional work does not seem as abstract as his two-dimensional work. There's something about the fact that two dimensions don't exist that makes it more thoroughly abstract. And as I say, that is my weakest argument. That's the thing I really like to figure out how to express, and I'm having a harder time with that aspect of the argument. Abstract painting seems to me to be the most reductive and the purest, and I use that term advisedly, the purest form of painting. And this seems evidenced by the fact that so many modern painters ended up painting monochrome paintings. There are painter after painter after painter in the 20th century that reduced the work, their two-dimensional work, to the monochrome, the monochromatic. And I've chosen Reinhardt and Rodchenko nearly half a century apart, about a half a century apart, to sort of represent the scores of monochrome painters that arrived at the single color painting. If you think about what the next step would be, if you're following this notion of modernist reduction, you eliminate and you eliminate and you eliminate and you arrive at the essence of painting, what do you arrive at? You arrive at the one color painting. Eliminate one more thing and you no longer have painting, right? That's the end of painting. The next step is the extinction of painting altogether. And both Rodchenko, a Russian artist from the post-revolutionary years, Rodchenko and Reinhardt, an American abstract expressionist, claimed to be making the last painting that could be made. Both of those artists claimed that theirs were the last paintings. Rodchenko's in 1918, Reinhardt's in 1960, but they still both thought that they were making the last painting. And one of the things that we saw in the 20th century was the endless prediction of the death of painting over and over, in the 19th and the 20th century, over and over again. Critics have proclaimed Robert Ryman the last abstract painter. He hasn't proclaimed himself the last abstract painter, as I'll say in the conclusion here, but he has this sort of critical weight behind him for making the last abstract painting. This he is the last to make this kind of painting. He is extremely self-aware. He knows exactly what he is doing. He's aware that he is repeating essentially the same white painting over and over and over and over, having made nothing but white paintings since the late 1950s, never anything but a white painting since the late 1950s, staving off painting's death through its repetition, sort of prolonging the death of painting by repeating the same painting over and over again. And that is general critical consensus. I mean, that's sort of the way Ryman is received these days, as prolonging the death of painting. Yves Alain Bois, on the other hand, who's painting The Task of Mourning, I mentioned a minute ago, uses Ryman to demonstrate another point, almost the opposite of the death of painting, and that is the death of abstraction. In Bois' argument, which is a very cogent and very and one that really illuminates the issues at stake, Bois argues that painting is like a tennis or a golf match, a tennis or a golf game, that painting is a game. It's an overall kind of pursuit, like a game of chess, a game of tennis, a game of golf. And within the game, that abstract painting is a match. It's a single match played of the game. It has a beginning and it has an end. And for Bois, abstraction has come to an end. The match is over, abstraction lost. It's out. It's gone, right? It's gone with the 20th century. While the game, that is the game of painting, continues. So Bois is arguing against the death of painting. And for him, Ryman signals that death of abstraction rather than the death of painting. On the other hand, the other artist whose work is always brought to the table in this discussion of the end of painting and the end of abstraction is Daniel Burin, the French artist who began making stripe paintings in the early 1960s. Stripe painting was a phenomenon in that decade, begun by Stella, I think, really, and then continued by hundreds of artists in Europe and the United States. At any rate, making stripe paintings in the early 1960s and then shifting to store-bought awning fabric, printed fabric, rather than endlessly painting the same stripes over and over and over again. He simply buys the fabric from the fabric store and uses it to stand for painting, to stand in for abstraction, recognizing then not the absurdity of or the impossibility of abstraction, but the impossibility of painting. So he argues the very opposite of Daniel Burin, of of Ryman, who is maintaining that abstraction might be over, but painting continues, or Bois's argument on Ryman, where Beren argues the opposite, that painting is over and abstraction continues. There is a wonderful quote by Gerhard Richter, the German painter, that is often used, is often summoned to the defense, in the defense of the death of painting, as a sort of eulogy, I guess, for painting. And Richter said, quote, "One must really be engaged in order to be a painter. Once obsessed by it, one eventually gets to the point where one thinks that humanity could be changed by painting. But when that passion deserts you, there is nothing else left to do. Then it is better to stop altogether, because basically, painting is pure idiocy." Which Beren demonstrates. Now, a very brief kind of synopsis of the death of painting and its proclaimers. As I said, the 19th and the 20th century have been just absolutely replete with declarations of the death of painting, which I'll unpack here in just a minute. Probably the first is Paul Delaroche, the French painter, and I've chosen one of his worst paintings here on the left to stand for him. He's painted a lot better things, but I thought this was just so kitschy that we had to look at it. Delaroche, who supposedly, I have not found the source for this quote, but it's been repeated ad infinitum, supposedly in 1839, when shown the first daguerreotype, declared from today, painting is dead. So that is as early as 1839, and I'm showing you Daguerre's early daguerreotype there on the right as a signal of photography's threat to painting. And this is the kind of classic death knell for painting is its association with photography. But Alan Caprow also declared that Pollock destroyed painting. That Pollock, in an article that he wrote in 1958, 2 years after Pollock's death, called The Legacy of Jackson Pollock, Caprow explained that Pollock had taken painting as far as it could go. And again, if you can think back to those days when there was this kind of linear progress from movement to movement, style period, era to era, in the pre-postmodern era, that artists were conscious of what to do next. What had their predecessors done, and what step could they take to go beyond their predecessors? That was just a kind of aspect of the way modernism unfolded. And Caprow and many of his peers saw no way out. They thought that Pollock had brought them to a dead end. He had taken painting as far as he could go, writing, "Pollock, quote, created some magnificent paintings, but he also destroyed painting," which is, I think, an apt summary of what everybody thought at the end of the 50s. It was a period of crisis that abstract expressionism had achieved this thoroughgoing kind of abstraction, and now what can one do? Caprow decided in the same Legacy of Jackson Pollock article that what one could do is build on the space in Pollock's paintings. In his paintings, he said, "Space is a continuum going simultaneously in all directions beyond the literal dimensions of any work." And this led Caprow to invent the happenings, which he did in 1958, and this is an early one from 62 on the left by Caprow, and where he takes the space of Pollock's paintings, Pollock's abstract fictional space, and makes it real, makes it literal, extends it out from the canvas out into the real world. So the pictorial fiction of Pollock's space is replaced by the real space of the gallery in the happenings of that period. Many critics, I notice more and more, attribute a death of painting prediction to Don Judd, who never actually called for the death of painting or predicted the death of painting. Actually, he predicted the death of sculpture, and I think he was right on in that. It was sculpture, he felt, that had no future after the mid-1960s. He wrote in 1964, "Since sculpture isn't so general a form as painting," in other words, painting is an empty rectangle. It's a sort of what he would call a general form. You can do anything within this this form. That sculpture isn't so general a form as painting. It can probably be only what it is now. And that would be David Smith, for example. That would be the work of the constructivists, late constructivists in Europe. That would be sculpture at mid-century. It can only be what it is now, which means that if it changes a great deal, it will be something else. So it's finished. And this was the way Jed wrote, it's finished. It's over. Sculpture's over. And it actually, I think, what he was right, absolutely right, in 1964, that sculpture was over. It was finished. And his work, which he said was not painting or sculpture, had nothing to do with either one of those forms, those media, that his work introduced, he didn't realize this, but I think we see it now, that his work really introduced what we now call installation. And very few people actually make sculptures that are sculpted and sit on little sculpture stands anymore. Those kinds of things are rare, although people still do produce that to some extent. But he did complain, Judd did complain, that painting was limited. It was a less general form than sculpture, given that in his time, he said this over and over, sculptures were statues, and they were, until Judd, that painting was limited by being a flat rectangle that was inherently illusionistic. So despite the great accomplishments of his friend Stella, he thought that Stella himself was limiting his vocabulary by remaining within the medium of painting. And Judd moved beyond that into what he said wasn't sculpture at all, and I agree with him, it is not sculpted in that traditional kind of sense, creating what he called specific objects that were neither painting nor sculpture. And then one of the landmarks in the death of painting is an article that, I don't know if you call it an article, but an anthology that Art Forum magazine published in September of 1975. Earlier in the year, they sent a questionnaire out to painters in the U.S., to artists who are identified as painters. About 100 artists, I think, they sent this letter to with these questions that I've kind of abbreviated the top portion of the letter there, but then these are the questions that they asked these painters to respond to. They published 35 replies in the September issue. It is a fascinating document, actually in support of painting. They thought they were going to get, you know, all this painting is over, painting is dead, everybody knows that kind of thing, but they didn't. They got 35 people saying that painting is as alive as ever and that it's as valuable and as pluralistic as possible. It allows for all kinds of expression and on and on and on. So it's a document that actually turned out to be more in support of painting than proclaiming its death. And yet, even then, painting, like today really, was not the dominant art form. People were painting, and they always have and they always will be painting, but it's not really the language of contemporary artists or now. It is no longer that sort of preeminent form of visual communication. Postmodernism, in a sense, I think we can see now that we're at some distance from its formulation, in critical formulation in the 1980s, I think we can see now that what it was an unmasking of myths. Modernism, Rosalind Krauss famously interpreted as a mythic system. And she, along with other critics, associated mostly with her journal, October Magazine, unpacked these myths of modernism, really revealing that the mechanics of modern art. The death of painting is essentially the loss of painting's mythic status. That is, painting was at one point the connective tissue of society. It's what held society together. It was the form of visual communication. And in that sense, it parallels the death of God. It isn't really that God was living and then he died and then he's no longer here. It's not really that painting was living and then it's died and it's no longer here. It's the death of the myth. It's the death of the widespread, wide acceptance of that social that connective fabric that holds society together, much in the way that Western Europe and America and the United States were held together by the myth of Christianity at some point. Not to say Christianity is not true, but it has a mythic structure to it. That is, it connects society, it connects humanity, because it's a shared belief system. And painting was a shared belief system at one point. And it is no, we have to admit that it is no longer a preeminent myth system. It isn't something that everybody believes in. It isn't something that everybody understands. It isn't the shared kind of consciousness that we have in our society. Postmodern communication is electronic. It is a communication that's done electronically. It isn't a visual form of communication that's done with a paintbrush. And that is the kind of communication that now reaches the largest number of people. And we've seen that, we can see that looking back, that development from painting to the photography in the 20th century, even the photography is invented in the 19th, it becomes a shared communication system in the 20th, and then electronic communication in our century. The second problem for painting is the loss of faith in transcendence. Modern artists and pre-modern artists, but especially modern artists, really believed that painting was transcendent, or that it could be transcendent, that it could lift you out of your everyday experience. And nobody is better at sort of representing that idea than Newman, with his use of the stripe, the vertical zip that leads you up. There is no way to look at a Newman painting for starting at the top and look down. You just can't do it. You have to look at the bottom and look up, and that signals this kind of transcendence that is reflected in the aesthetic experience that is so much part of the modern myth, that takes us out of our everyday cares, and we lose track of the world and who's standing in the museum beside us. And the ultimate aesthetic experience, of course, is the Stendhal syndrome, where you faint, you swoon, because the art has elevated you so high up in the air. On the other hand, Philip Taff is much less transcendental, not like so many painters of his generation, having lost faith in that transcendent experience. In response to Barnett Newman's essay of 1948, "The Sublime Is Now," Taff wrote in 1986, "Sublimity now and forever, amen," as an ironic kind of rejection of that possibility of transcendence. And the critic Douglas Crimp, I think, has unmasked transcendence perhaps better than any other, revealing it really as an ideological construction. That is, the aesthetic experience that one has where one's sort of elevated in front of a painting and you're not aware of the world around you is one that we impose on our experience of painting. It is a cultural, it's a learned rather than a natural response to painting. And I've never had more anecdotal proof for this than a recent graduate student who asked in one of my seminars, it might have been last year or the year before, why her art history professor in undergraduate school told her she was supposed to cry in front of a Rothko. And she had no idea why she was supposed to cry in front of a Rothko. And I don't either, except that they teach us to cry in front of a Rothko. And I know I did it, too, when I was in college. I guess I was taught to do that. But that seems to me to totally be the proof of that whole notion. And then finally, it's really the loss of belief in self-expression, in the notion that gesture is a sign, that artistic gesture is a sign of emotion. And this is a sort of classic kind of comparison, talking about the use of gesture as a sign of feeling and personal emotion in de Kooning's work, and the rejection of that in the very anonymous application of paint that you see in Jasper Johns's work on the right. Before postmodernism, neo-dada artists, pop artists, minimal artists all rejected the gestural mark as being an egotistic kind of a symbol of egotism, of the artist's self-absorption, that I am so absorbed with my own feelings, I have to get them out and let everybody see them on canvas. And we see a whole generation prior to postmodernism really rejecting this notion, which Max Kozloff noted in 1975 was totally ironic, that there were even artists who painted if they didn't want to express themselves, since he maintained that paint is an inherently expressive medium. It's plastic. plasticity, its pliability, its manipulability. It makes it an expressive medium. And as a kind of icon of expression, I'm bringing here Munch's The Scream from 1889 with a younger artist on the right, James Hayward, from 1998, to suggest that now gesture has a different implication than it did in Munch's time and the modern period. I mean, most of us have learned that Munch's sinuous line is to represent the reverberations of this tortured cry in nature. And yet one of Hayward's critics, a supportive critic, Jeremy Gilbert Rolfe, has pointed out that gesture, and especially impasto, the kind of thick paint that Hayward uses in the work on the right, is always misread as self-expressive. He says, if at any time an abstract painter uses thick paint, he or she is immediately said to have become expressionist. The idea that the presence of marks directly reminiscent of the artist's body means that the work is in some way a direct expression of the artist is wrong. The mark is in no sense a diminished reference to the referent who made it. That there is no reason other than, again, a kind of cultural one to associate a mark with the body, that the identity of the body that that made it. And Frederick Jameson has also argued, the Marxist critic Frederick Jameson has also argued so convincingly against the idea of expression, self-expression, expression of personal feeling as even a possibility, rejecting Munch's attempt, which he thinks is a failed attempt, because of two basic contradictions. One is that Munch presupposes a duality, an inside that is where the feeling is located, and an outside where the feeling is expressed on the canvas, for example, of human beings. Human beings, he said, were considered to be what he calls monads, which is a great word. There's no other word to replace monad. A singular being, an indivisible being. The problem of expression, he says, is itself closely tied to the conception of the subject as a monad-like container within which things felt are then expressed and projected outward. So the human being, the classical sort of modernist human being, is a singular being. And yet the problems he sees in that notion of expression is the presumption that there are two parts of this being. If it's a singular being, then it doesn't have an inside and an outside. It has only one shape to it. It's a singular thing, not a dualistic thing, which is what a outside and an inside implies. And then secondly, he says that Munch is presuming that an oral cry that should be heard with the ears, he says, which are most notably missing on Munch's monad, can be represented in paint in an optical medium. That Munch is presuming that he can represent a sound in paint. Postmodernism is really brought about by the end of the monad, by the end of this singular, unique individual or ego, as Jameson phrases it. Now what we have is a decentered, fragmented subject who is not singular, who doesn't have this enduring essence. There isn't any longer a unique self or an ego there to do the expressing, which is the argument against the notion of self-expression. And it is with Jameson and the assistance of Jean Baudrillard, a French philosopher, sociologist, that I get to this way of understanding abstraction in our era, the role and responsibility of abstract painting in the 21st century. And to do that, I need to broaden my sights just a bit, and that's visually done by including three slides instead of two, which is standard in art history. Jameson has posited in his book Postmodernism or the Cultural Expression of Late Capitalism, I think is the title of it, Cultural Expression of Late Capitalism. Jameson has proposed that there are three major periods in culture that correspond to realism, modernism, and postmodernism. And I have arbitrarily suggested or selected examples of realism, modernism, and postmodernism. Baudrillard, on the other hand, has three periods, but they're a little bit different. His periods are modernism, modernism his first period he calls the classical period. In the 18th through the mid 19th century, the second period is the modern period, the 19th and the 20th, and then the post-industrial period in the late 20th and 21st. So essentially, Jameson's postmodernism corresponds to the post-industrial period that Baudrillard posited, and that is, again, it's a sort of cultural or historical way of thinking about postmodernism, that it corresponds to post-industrial society. It reflects post-industrial industrial society, and that these three cultural movements or moments correspond to imitation with the classical or realist period, mass production with the modern period, and simulation, as Baudrillard frames it, in the postmodern period. And he has most brilliantly, I think, illustrated those three periods by conjuring up the automaton as the representation of the realist mimetic period of imitation, where a mechanical figure imitates a human being. It looks just like a human being, and scrounged the internet and found an automaton on the left from the 19th century to stand for the mechanical figure that imitates a human being. This is a robot, a Pierrot clown that writes with a mechanized motor. And a robot, which stands for the modern period, the period of mass production, in which the robot is is not an imitation of man. It's not an anthropomorphic image. It doesn't look like a man, but rather it's the equivalent of man, a productivist, task-oriented being, right? That solves whatever kinds of things you tell it to do. That takes care of the tasks set before us. And then finally, the computer, which has nothing to do with the appearance of man, but rather is a simulation of man's thought processes or computational skills and abilities, but it doesn't look like a human being at all. And then I can further sort of illustrate the modern postmodern dialectic, I suppose, with the work of Frank Stella, standing for a kind of mass production in the studio. At this point, Stella did not have assistants making his works, but he produces all of his works in series that look like slightly varied mass-produced objects that are all sort of the same thing that come off the as if they had come off the assembly line. Where Peter Halley's work is clearly an abstract painting, but not a representation of a specific abstract painting, rather a simulation of an abstract painting, not a reproduction of an abstract painting, but an altogether new, as he says, a copy without an original, sort of like a computer and a man. The painting looks like an abstraction, but is really a simulation of the idea of abstraction. And these three periods, I think, have been cogently and really concisely made into an analogy by the artist Peter Halley, who makes the analogy with money. And he says the first period is a period of imitation, in which coins represent a portrait of the sovereign, of the leader of the empire. The second period is a period of mass production, in which paper money represents the government and has no real value in itself. It's just a piece of paper. The third is the postmodern era and the credit card, in which a credit card simulates cash. It doesn't look like cash, but it simulates cash with no inherent value at all. And very much as money circulates in society, so do Halley's images in his paintings, that he sets them up on this model of cells and circuits and motherboards and computers, the layout of a computer, the layout of cities, the layouts of cafeterias and hospitals and all kinds of architectural situations based on geometry in which people circulate in our society, which makes this a perfect mural for the airport, since the airport is all about circulation, right? About moving people, moving baggage on the carousel, moving airplanes and so forth. So it's a sort of ideal mural for the airport. I had originally in my book that I published in 2002 on abstraction, also seeing that there were three periods, but my focus was narrower. And now what I'm doing, I think, is I'm broadening my focus to extend at least back into the 19th century, if not before. Earlier, before I got a hold of Jameson and kind of fitted into the system, I had set out, proposed three phases. Halley, of course, initiated the third phase, the postmodern phase of abstraction. Stella, the second phase of abstraction, where abstraction was no longer a verb having to do with abstracting from, but was a noun, where abstraction is a noun. It's a received idea. Stella doesn't have to start from nature in the way, for example, that Kandinsky starts from nature with a landscape on the left and then progressively abstracts to arrive at a non-representational image on the right. And Kandinsky initiates the first phase of abstraction, when abstraction is a process of distillation, of pulling out from observable reality. And it's here that Diebenkorn, I think, fits. And I'm not really going to talk about Diebenkorn, but I thought I'd sort of throw him in as examples every now and then, that Diebenkorn is certainly not looking at the landscape in the creation of the Ocean Park paintings, but he's thinking the landscape. And he's thinking, again, as I said, about the lived time and the lived experience of the landscape. More, I think, in terms of the memories he's got about views of Santa Monica, where he's living and Ocean Park is located, the rooftops, the ocean, the mountains, not necessarily looking at nature, but still distilling that essence. And then there are three phases here. Right? The three phases we've outlined are realism, modernism, and postmodernism. Those in Jameson's theory are derived from, if you're curious, they're derived from a writer named Ernest Mandel, an historian who wrote a PhD dissertation in 1972 called Late Capitalism. And that is his source. And in that book, Mandel theorizes three periods of capitalism: market capitalism, monopoly capitalism, and global or multinational capitalism. Those three periods from the 19th century, market capitalism, monopoly capitalism in the early 20s.